Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment. Master Commissioner Margaret Mayer presiding.
Please be seated. We have one case to be heard this morning. It's number 2012-1648. Marysville Exempted Village School District versus Union County Board of Revision. Mr. Liggett for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I have with me Philip Conley of Conley Construction, the principal. I want to start with, I think the obvious theme of this case is that there's really no ambiguity in the statutory authority, and with the December decision in Columbus School Board, there's really no there's little to argue today. But I do want to make a distinguishing point in that regard. I do think it's also important to recognize, Your Honor, that there is no cross appeal. The tax commissioner has never appeared. The Board of Revision has never appeared. This has been a technical kick the can down the road. And of importance to Conley Construction is there's three other cases. There's two in the Court of Appeals and there's one here in the Supreme Court that's following this on the same exact point. What's of course in the Columbus City School District, I didn't file supplemental authority. I assume this court knew it, maybe even wrote the decision. So, but I think it nails the point is the act of filling out a fact affidavit is not the practice of law. And that court, of course, held that the Dayton Supply and Tool case actually supported that conclusion. The only support in the Board of Tax Appeals decision is the Dayton Tool and Supply. And in our briefing, we noted what the Board of Tax Appeals took that sentence, which was completely out of context. And what's particularly frustrating is that this court also has already issued in the Toledo School Board the same decision. And my learned opposition, of course, points out there's certain factual differences in the underlying case, but the decision on the law was the same, and that is that it's not a jurisdictional issue when no attorney has performed the act of preparing and filing a complaint. That was the Toledo case. And we briefed that with the Board of Tax Appeals.
Well, it's in the Toledo case, though, wasn't there was a lawyer representing whoever it was, the entity that filed the complaint. A lawyer prepared and filed the complaint for that entity.
No, the lawyer did not prepare and file a complaint. That's the important point. In this case, I represented this client as well the day after it was filed. So there's no issue of representing the client. This is the verbatim. It was actually italicized in the Toledo case. Quote, what the legislature did intend was to furnish a list of persons who may file when no attorney has performed the act of preparing and filing the complaint. That's the holding of this Supreme Court in 2010.
Well, but my question to you was, mm-hmm. in the facts of that case, mm-hmm. there had been a lawyer who had filed on behalf of the entity, and the question was, yeah. What about the relationship between, what was it, the developer and the management company, mm-hmm. I think it was.
I don't believe that's accurate. I don't think the lawyer signed the complaint. And there's a series of these, as you know, Your Honor. You've read all these cases. Washington Public Schools, the same way. GEMO, before that, was years ago, where you had the, I think it was the real estate agent had signed the complaint. And the key, I think we all agree, is in December, this court said, it's a fact affidavit. It's not a pleading of law. And I think, I want to digress just momentarily. When I went to school in Washington, D.C. during the Watergate hearings, and Judge Sirica made the comment that little did America know what a constitutional crisis it was, that Marbury versus Madison was at risk. What authority does the court have in the Constitution to render decisions over executive agencies? Of course, that was judicially created. And what happens when the president says, I'm not going to abide by that? I think that's what's going on here. You have the Board of Tax Appeals repeatedly finding dicta or ignoring precedent. They didn't render it like you've just argued, well, Toledo's different. They just ignore it. And it's frustrating. This court also in Castle said, BTA has no authority to declare a statute unconstitutional, just follow it. And yet that's what they do. And I think the troublesome part, I think there's two things this court could do today. One, the very easy thing, is to simply say, reversed on authority of Columbus School District. But I think there's a better opportunity. In the Columbus School District, this court has said, it's a fact affidavit. Of course, anybody can sign that fact. And I think the we've put it in our brief, a direct example is a police officer giving a speeding ticket. That speeding ticket, if you look at it, is an affidavit. It says State of Ohio, County of Franklin, and he signs it as I saw you speed. It would be completely inappropriate for a county prosecutor to sign that because he didn't see anybody speed. And more importantly, under the Constitution, you have a right of cross-examination under due process. We've actually did this at the Board of Revision, where in one of the cases, the attorney signed the pleading as under penalty of perjury, and we called him as a witness, and they refused. And I think that's the corollary that's missing from the precedent. If, in fact, anyone who has fact can sign the fact affidavit, which is the BTA's form or the Department of Taxation's form, how is it then that a lawyer can sign a fact affidavit? There's only one instance in which that lawyer can do so, if that lawyer has personal knowledge and is subject to cross-examination.
But certainly before the legislature put the provisions that are currently in 5715.19A, mm-hmm. in that 1999 mm-hmm. piece of legislation, the case law would have appeared to indicate that in this case there would be a dismissal, right, or not.
I don't think it indicated dismissal.
Your theory seems to goes beyond the fact that there's now statutory authority.
No, I don't think it was dismissal. In fact, this court has said that it is inappropriate. It strictly is the unauthorized practice of law, and that is not a jurisdictional issue. And there's another disjunction. Let's assume, for instance, before the statute it was the unauthorized practice of law. That still doesn't mean you dismiss the case. And that gets to the reality. Citygate is Mr. Connolly's development. It's multiple parcels. The Board of Revision found that the value is too high. And so on the basis that, even though he has a lawyer there, on the basis that he signed a fact affidavit, his employee, we now have to go with a higher valuation? That makes no sense. And this court has already said repeatedly, it's not a jurisdictional issue. In GEMO, an agent was always allowed. You know, and that's where I think those are precedent to the statute. And that was the case law before. The statute made it clear, and we've quoted the legislative history, the sponsor saying, this is ridiculous. Is, you know, you can't have a spouse of a person or an employee, and that's what the intent of the statutory was, really a clarification. It was not the first time that those could be done. And I think as well, again, where I think this court should focus is the Department of Taxation has prescribed a state form, and it's an affidavit, and it says swear under perjury. Now, if they wanted that to be a pleading, why don't they change that? I don't sign mechanics liens affidavits. I don't have any fact. I don't sign a speeding ticket. Neither does the prosecutor. And I think it's the other half of the coin. The court has repeatedly said, well, yes, in this instance you can sign. Yes, in this instance you can sign. Let's get to the other half of the unauthorized practice.
Let me ask you another question. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, there are a number of other cases that mm-hmm. Your client mm-hmm. has pending, including, I guess, one out of the third district.
Two in the third district, yeah.
And in this case, there is virtually no record because the dismissal, I think, occurred before the Board of Revision sent the record to the BTA.
No, there's a sideline, but the record is expressly only on the point of the salaried employee signed the complaint.
So is there actually evidence? I guess my point is there actually evidence of that in
yes.
the current record?
Yes, and there's no disagreement among counsel. That's true. And the salaried employee signed it because the statute says so and the case law says so. And then the BTA, upon motion of the party in all four cases, does so and says, in a footnote, by the way, county auditor, would you send the record? You had 30 days and you didn't do that. It really has nothing to do with the substance.
So I guess just to complete my question, mm-hmm. if the court were to agree that as a matter of law, the salaried employee can mm-hmm. submit the complaint on behalf of the corporation, it's in your view, it's not necessary to send it back to the BTA to determine whether or not a salaried employee did in fact submit the affidavit. That's clearly evidence.
No issue, no disagreement there. And as I understand too, the record's been submitted finally. So we go back, it's remanded to the BTA, and we go back on the, as a routine case on the merits. In this case, again, it's their appeal that the Board of Revision reduced the value, and it is particularly difficult, you know, in theory, we could keep on filing or refile, but this is, it's so silly that Board of Revision did this work on like 48 parcels, and because of this one issue, we're in four different courts. It's very frustrating. And I guess I am concerned that there needs to be an end to this generally as a public policy. We're here in the right place to make that statement. And this court could issue an opinion, say, well, salaried employees are okay. Well, what's the next one they're going to say? And the only solution to that is to, what I really think is the underlying issue is, they keep saying the statute is unconstitutional because it's the unauthorized practice of law. The corollary ought to be stated. How can a lawyer with no personal knowledge sign a fact affidavit? And this court can say, you know, if in fact the lawyer happens to have the fact information, that's one thing, but they're subject to cross-examination then, aren't they? Just like the police officer signing the ticket. And I don't think that because the court has already said repeatedly, this is not an issue of jurisdiction. The unauthorized practice of law is not an issue of jurisdiction. So it doesn't disrupt the ongoing casework otherwise. But that puts an end to this debate, because now lawyers are now on notice. Do you really intend to sign this as a witness? And how hard is it to have anybody else in the world, any of your clients sign it, including the counterclaims? That ought to be the rule of law here. That's what the intent of the legislature was. That's what all of the cases support from the Supreme Court, and that's where the common sense ought to lie. Let's get back to the facts are non-lawyers, and the lawyers need to be there to pursue the legal case.
Under your theory that you're advancing, it might still matter if an attorney actually prepared the complaint. Mm-hmm. Even if a fact witness actually signed the affidavit portion.
I would agree with you if the Department of Taxation would prepare a complaint form. Mm-hmm. They have not. They prepared an affidavit. So take their pick. It's their it's in their control. It's not a complaint. We refer to it as a complaint. Mm-hmm. We refer to a speeding ticket as a ticket. But the reality is they're both affidavits. And so, I think this deserves clarification. Did you intend it to be an affidavit, Department of Taxation? Then make it an affidavit. It's not a complaint. It's not a pleading. Or here's you've just raised what would be a marvelous thing. Why not say it's sufficient? I mean, this Department of Taxation. Why not say it's sufficient to invoke the Board of Revision's jurisdiction by an attorney filing a pleading? Word complaint, word affidavit. I don't have any objection to that. That's what you've just described, is it's a preparation of a legal document.
Well, of course, being an administrative proceeding, the statutes control what has to be filed.
So statute doesn't say affidavit. You know, the Department of Taxation came up with this form on their own. And I think they've gotten themselves into this pickle on their own. And then they get to the Board of Tax Appeals and they kick it down the can down the road any way they can. And they've been historically, just by tradition, lawyers sign these complaints. There's nothing in the statute that says that, absolutely nothing. And so I think we've got to, I think it's consistent with this court's opinion in December. Wait a minute, you're making a statement of fact here. If you want the form to be a pleading, do that. Pass a rule that says attorneys file a pleading. I don't care, but that's not what their form is. And I'm not gonna sign the form that they say. Under penalty of perjury, I know that the value is X. I have no idea what the value is. I'm their lawyer. And so I'm in the predicament, as we were in this case, do I sign, or is the statutory and the Supreme Court going to control what the BTA decides? I think it's the latter.
Thank you, Mr. Liggett.
Thank you.
Ms. Kalale.
Thank you. I think that the general rule of the preparation and filing of a complaint with a county board of revision on behalf of a taxpayer that constitutes the practice of law is still good law. That has not been overruled. What we have seen are carved out exceptions for a specific list of persons that the General Assembly has added to 5715.19 to allow that individual to file a complaint. A complaint, it says it right on the top of the form, it is a complaint with the County Board of Revision. Now, Dayton Supply only answered the question as it related to a corporate officer. And in that case, there was a distinction made that a corporate officer has a fiduciary duty to the company and therefore has a special relationship as it relates to the corporation. The Dayton Supply case carved out a very narrow exception to permitting a layperson to engage in the practice of law. Since Dayton, the BTA, in this case and in others that are related to this case, have analyzed that their decisions on who can file a complaint based on the existence of a fiduciary relationship that was set forth in Dayton. Since Dayton, I recognize that this case, that the court in Columbus, the most recent decision, has also allowed and ruled on whether or not a spouse can file a complaint on behalf of another spouse. That is yet another exception that the General Assembly has carved out. I do believe that there is still a window left to deal with the other individuals that the legislature has listed as to who can file a complaint on behalf of another person or company.
But didn't the court's decision in December point out that the spouses don't usually have that fiduciary relationship with each other, and nonetheless it was okay to have the spouse file?
Yes, that is exactly what they said. However, they also said that while a spouse doesn't necessarily have a fiduciary duty to another spouse, they are, however, bound together in an ongoing relationship of mutual support. So again, they are looking at the relationship between the spouses, expecting there to be some sort of ongoing relationship that allows one spouse to file on behalf of another. The court's decision in Columbus admittedly makes it a little more difficult to stand here today to say that a salaried employee cannot file a complaint on behalf of a corporation. But I believe that the court still has the ability to render that portion of the statute invalid, and I believe that in other cases it is said that they are looking at this on a case-by-case basis with respect to the class of individuals that have been allowed to file.
What about Mr. Liggett's point that the complaint form in form is an affidavit and that complicates this issue?
I don't believe that has been distinguished at all in any of these cases where that's been called an affidavit. I think it goes back to the beginning of my argument where I said that Sharon Village and the practice of law and the fact of a filing of a complaint, the preparing and filing of a complaint, is still the practice of law. I still think that is good law, and that has not been touched by any of these cases. I think that the court has consistently recognized that it's the practice of law to sign and file a complaint. And in fact, Toledo, reason why that's not applicable here today is because there was an attorney that signed and prepared. Well, I'm not sure about the signed. Mr. Liggett takes exception with that, but I think that the court distinguished that because there was an attorney that had prepared and filed the complaint. And so there was no question about whether or not it was the unauthorized practice of law. But I do believe that even following the Columbus case, that there is still room to rule that a salaried employee does not have that type of relationship. Just because it's a salaried employee does not mean that there is going to be any fiduciary duty or relationship or any special relationship. And I think about a situation where clients that I represent is in this particular case a Board of Education. They have a lot of salaried employees. A teacher is a salaried employee. Does that mean that a teacher can file as a salaried employee on behalf of a Board of Education with absolutely no knowledge or no special relationship or no investment necessarily in the valuation of its property or any other property? I think that is room for a lot of abuse of discretion to open that up to allow salaried employees to file on behalf of a company.
Well, I guess really, what really would be the harm? I mean, if an employee is instructed to go file a complaint, presumably the corporation's interests are being served, and the remedy for here actually is against the party that's trying to complain, right? Because what happens in these cases is the complaint gets dismissed, and the complaining party loses the ability to challenge the value for a particular year. So, and if in fact the salaried employee goes off on a frolic of its own and files a complaint without authorization, can't that just be dealt with by having a proper agent come in and obtain dismissal of the complaint rather than making it a jurisdictional issue?
Well, I suppose that could be the case. However, when you asked the question, you said that an employee could be instructed, a salaried employee could be instructed by a company to file a complaint. But there is, if you allow a salaried employee to file a complaint without evidence of or a verification that that and salaried employee has some kind of fiduciary duty and knowledge of the corporation and authorization by that corporation, then, you know, that would allow a whole host of individuals, salaried employees, on behalf of a corporation to file a complaint. And it could be a disgruntled salaried employee, and there's no indication of what that value could be. A request to increase the value. If a corporate, let's just say that if the Board of Revision had a hearing and the salaried employee signed and filed a complaint on behalf, a disgruntled salaried employee on behalf of a corporation comes to a Board of Revision and says, I believe that the value is currently at $1 million, should be $5 million. And the corporation says, we don't have any, this salaried employee has no authorization from our company to file a complaint. There's nothing there that says that salaried employee can proceed with that complaint.
That would be no different from anybody in the street coming in and purporting to represent the complaining entity and saying, we're complaining, when in fact the entity didn't give any authorization to file the complaint. So
there's no requisite. The statute allows a salaried employee to file a complaint. That's all it says. Without this court giving more guidance to who that salaried employee can be, requiring a fiduciary duty, that's exactly what I'm concerned about, is that allowing any salaried employee off the street that works for a corporation to be able to file a complaint. Because that is that's where this court is leading if it suggests that or allows a salaried employee to file a complaint with no boundaries or no guidance.
Of course, the same argument could be made about spouses, right? I mean, one spouse might go and try to put one over on the other, I suppose, and say, well, I'm actually going to mess with the value of the property. But wouldn't the remedy for that just be to have the other spouse, or in this case, the entity that owns the property, come in after the fact and say, nobody, this person never acted as an agent with any authority from us?
Okay, but if there's nothing to say that they have to have that agency or authority, then that's disgruntled spouse or disgruntled salary employee would have the ability to come before a Board of Revision with expert appraisal witness or expert appraiser and argue the valuation of the property. I mean, I'm concerned that that would be a reality. I believe that the BTA has made a correct, accurate decision in this case. It followed. It did not rule, another point that I wanted to make, it did not rule that the statute was unconstitutional. It followed the McDonald's Court of Appeals decision. The McDonald's Court of Appeals decision did rule that the statute was unconstitutional. So the BTA was acting within the boundaries of the law and upheld the McDonald's decision, or followed the McDonald's decision and its decision to dismiss this case on jurisdictional issues. I do not believe that it ever indicated or ruled that the statute is unconstitutional.
Well, but it would necessarily be the case that that the statute, I mean, because there would be a clear conflict. I mean, your position would prevail in this case, only if the state constitution prohibits the General Assembly from authorizing the salaried employee to file.
Yes, correct? I agree with that. I think that if the court is going to rule that a salaried employee does not have the ability to file a complaint, it would have to rule that portion of the statute as unconstitutional.
And you're saying it was appropriate in this case, or the BTA had cover, so to speak, to do it in this case because of the third district decision.
Yes, and I understand that whether the third district court of appeals can rule a statute unconstitutional is currently before this court, so that's for another argument for another day. But the Board of Tax Appeals itself had good case law at the time to dismiss the complaint that was filed in this case. Any more questions? That's all.
Do you have any more?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Galeo. Mr. Leggett, you've reserved a minute and 24 seconds.
Okay, thank you. Number one, McDonald's, saying McDonald's was foul, followed as bootstrapping. McDonald's is Connolly. It's the same case, except a different parcel. BTA ruled it unconstitutional, gave it to the Court of Appeals, and they said so. I mean, so this is bootstrapping. It's kind of a silly argument. But more importantly, salary.
Well, but does the BTA have the duty then to follow? Suppose this court, I mean, certainly the BTA has a duty to follow what this court would say about whether or not these complaints can be, you know, determined or heard jurisdictionally.
More importantly, Castle out of this court, Castle Aviation v. Wilkins, says that BTA has a duty to follow the statute. They can't say it's unconstitutional. And what they've done is, well, we didn't use that word. Well, what they did was say it's the unauthorized practice of law. BTA said that, not the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ratified it by declaring the statute unconstitutional on its face. But BTA has no authority to do that. This court said so, and BTA is ignoring it. And here's the, I'm frankly delighted counsel made the argument she did, because she just told this court exactly what I said was going to happen. Well, this is just one more, this is one example, and that she used the word, I believe, it was a carve out, and that there's still a window left. Really? Dayton Supply did not say it had to be a fiduciary duty. That was dicta. It said, by example, this is a fiduciary duty, so we're going to allow that. The issue is unauthorized practice of law, and it's not a carve out. And if this court doesn't put an end to this, there's going to be any number of other cases continue on this same point. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Leggett. This case will be submitted. And the court will advise the parties of its decision.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now standing adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.